minute or two, a study on atonement and intercession of Christ. The appendix is primarily a definition, a defining of terms. Terms essential in the study of atonement. And you notice it begins with kafar, the most used term. And as you get down into that, it's very exciting. To cover, to draw over, to forgive, to cover an offense from the eye of the offended one. This is God in this case. The name given to the mercy seat, which was the lid or covering of the Ark of the Covenant. Averting some dreaded consequence by means of a substitutionary interposition. Salvation from sin and wrath by a ransom of infinite worth. That's the primary word that's used in the Old Testament. And then Greek word in the New Testament. And incidentally, I just ask that you would keep praying for Sandy and her father. He's here. He arrived for Wednesday. And as I went up to pray with them, the other day, here he is sitting there right beside his daughter, and hadn't seen her for 40 years, holding her hand. And I talked to Gene down there, that was Wednesday, and Gene says he's still not talked out. He says he's just talking out these past 40 years. He's just talking them out, talking them out. See, the woman that he married when he left them and their family died just about 2 weeks ago. And as she was buried, then he left to come back here to see his daughter, whom he had not seen for 40 years. And as I prayed with him there, I prayed God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. I found that was the key thought that God had put in my heart. And I believe that this whole subject of second reconciliation in 2 Corinthians is such an essential factor. And when there's a reconciliation with the Father in heaven, then there can be a reconciliation with the Father on earth and the Father and the daughter and everyone else on earth. But that relationship with the Trinity is the thing that establishes the basis for a relationship with everyone else on earth. Please be praying for Sandy and her father, Fuque, be praying for them these days. Not only atonement, but then reconciliation and redemption and ransom and propitiation and substitution and satisfaction. Vicarious. That word vicarious is a very, very important word, although it does not appear in the Bible. And expiation does not appear in the Bible, but it's still a very important word. And then I've sort of tried to summarize that and draw those words together on the very last page in the book up there. And I've tried to put it up in such a way that you could write those words and use them in a sentence. I think that's one way of learning a definition, to be able to use a word in a sentence. But let's go back and look at the outline for a little bit. At the bottom of page 5, now we didn't number them, but if you start counting and then keep your count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at the bottom of page 5, the paragraph at the very bottom of page 5 begins by saying the book did have its theological significance. Atonement theology can be separated into three very general groupings or types. This should be familiar to you. The moral influence theory. And then the governmental influence theory. And the penal substitution. If I had that to write again, if I'd been writing carefully, I would have written that as the penal substitution school. That's not a theory. That is a school. And probably I would have called all of them that. Beginning on page 8... you have the doctrine of the nature of atonement. And I would like you to be able to put together not just a definition, but to shoot at a definition. And then right under that definition there on page 8, subject, the page being the nature of atonement, sin, what is sin? A violation of God's honor, an insult to His majesty, a thing to be abhorred, a debt to be paid, invasion made against the stability and authority of the moral constitution, government of the great lawgiver, and as such a threat to the good of all His moral subjects. It's sticking your finger into the eye of God. And you may feel bad. You may suffer all kinds of things as a result of sin. But the important thing is what it means to God. This is why David in his great psalm of confession there says, against thee and thee only have I sinned. Well, he sinned against Bathsheba. He sinned against her husband, killed him, had him killed. He sinned against the nation. He sinned against the church. What's he mean? He says, compared to these, the important thing is I sinned against God. It's what I did to God. And that's the real basis of confession. It's really a false confession. When you try to make any other confession of sin, this is why so many people do not find forgiveness, because they're confessing the symptoms. In fact, I just heard an illustration of that today about the little boy. Dad says, and Mom says, don't go out and play in the street. He says, I'm going out and play in the street. He goes out and plays the street. Gets his leg broken. He comes back and asks Mother to forgive him for getting his leg broken. And that's the way it is with us. When we ask God to forgive us for the results, but we don't ask God to forgive us for the sin. And sin, and then comes the subject of God, prompted by love, resolved to save men, in the covenant of peace, made by the Trinity and eternity. Is how the Trinity is related to this. Had issued those decrees, made those appointments, established those terms on the basis of which you might make the necessary adjustments to dispense with the letter of the law. He that sinneth, the soul that sinneth, shall surely die. But the soul that sinneth does not finally die. God had to accept a commutative satisfaction, while at the same time making sure His justice was in no way violated. And then Christ, the top of that next page, there's sin, there's God, there's Christ. And then finally, in that same sentence, men were made to be at one with God. Or rather, God was brought to be at one with His people. The two parties were reconciled, brought into a state of good agreement through this work of Christ. Going on then to the subject on page 8. I'm sorry. Going on then to the subject on page 14, the necessity for atonement. We've already studied a little bit of that, and the secondary reasons as well as the first reasons. God's original decision to save souls based upon love, His love. He just loved. The love of the Trinity extended to man. And then the secondary reasons, that was the basic reason. But then the relative, then came the other reasons. After God had resolved to save men, then four things rendered the atonement necessary. And going on next to page 18 is the reality or proof of atonement. And you find a history of sacrifice coming into view there. The ancient sacrifices, the Levitical sacrifices, the sacrifices of Christ, the New Testament sacrifices. When was it that Christ began to suffer? When did Christ begin to suffer? When was the lamb slain? Before the foundation of the world. And the poet said from his birth he was a slaying. From the time that he was born, he was in the act of dying. But it was while he was there on the cross that the penalty was really paid. He suffered the pangs of hell for eternity for every person who should have been in hell but will be in heaven for eternity. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? He was forsaken by the Father. That was while he was on the cross. But as he left that cross, he was back in the presence of the Father. He suffered an eternity in relatively few minutes of time. And then going on to on page 20, the matter or substance of the sacrifice, that's really what I was just now talking about. And on page 22, the value of atonement. And then the extent of atonement. Who all were saved? Who all are involved in this? And that's really the battleground of the doctrine of atonement, the subject of the extent of atonement. There's been more debates and books written on that subject. Who is and who is not within that? And then the results of atonement. that's over on page 33. Beg pardon? Footnote 140. Right above footnote 140. Yes. And then after the results of atonement comes the intercession of Christ, clear over at the very end, the intercession of Christ. The intercession of Christ, the prayer that Christ was praying there in John 17, is based upon his work of atonement. And it's just a tremendously important connection there to catch the connection between Christ's ongoing intercession, what he prays in heaven for you and me today, and how he prays, who he prays for, and the results of that. Well, this may help you in answering some of the questions in the booklet, and it may also give you some more questions, but I wanted you to have this to take home and work on, and I'm not going to give you a close examination over this booklet, but there will be some questions on the subject of atonement in your final exam. Any questions on the overall booklet or just the review of the doctrine of atonement? We'll take up more of it later on. This is part of my writing, yes. Just one little part of it, yes. I believe that what I want now is that you would see this film by Dr. Gerschner. I think that's about what we're going to have time for this evening. And at the end of it, you will be getting into the subject of presuppositionalism, and I'll be very much interested in getting your response to that as we go along. Beg pardon?
Which film is the second
century? We're going to work on second century, the Church of the Apostolic Fathers and Apologists. Yes, let's hand it out. Thank you, Heather. Can we take that one out? Is that loud enough? The shorter film this evening, number one is because of the time, but also because of the subject that he ends up with there. Why did apologetics come into the picture here at this time in the history of the church?
Since they were impacting the society, the Christians were impacting society.
And there were a lot of other philosophies that they were in competition with. What is presuppositionalism? And what's the difference between that and the classic evidential apologetics, presuppositional apologetics, and the classical evidential? Do you see the difference between the two? You tell me.
Well, you said you have to presuppose God.
Yeah.
And then from that you deduce or you reason that Christ could do miracles because he was God. Rather than seeing the miracles, the particulars, and then moving, this must be God. That's a more general statement.
So Duivert and Vintel and those men are assuming the universal and then going to the particulars. Is that?
That's right, Steve. But with Gerstner, you can't assume that miracles exist without God. I mean, so I think even he would have to come back and say, well, I can't make any of these kinds of statements unless God were to exist. So I guess I differ with him, or I see him as being maybe semantically different, not actually different.
Okay, can you explain the difference? Can each one of you explain the difference between presuppositionalism and evidential or classical apologetics? Yes.
That's just my feeling. I'm no expert on the subject. I think I don't think you can really just choose one over the other. A lot of it has to do with the culture. There are people now who presuppose that the Bible is myth. And they don't realize that they are making that presupposition. They presuppose that it is merely utterly unreliable literature with utterly unreliable textual history, and that it is on the same level as the Iliad and the Odyssey and the fables about Jupiter and all that. And you have to bring people down to these assumptions, because in the first and second century, everyone assumed that there were divine powers. That was never really questioned. Now that assumption comes under a great deal of questioning. In fact, the naturalist will assume precisely the opposite, that there is nothing but matter in motion. And the Marxist, the dialects for materialism, the materialism presupposes that there is nothing besides matter and energy, and the dialectical part presupposes a method of reasoning which is not mathematically logical, going from thesis and antithesis to a new thesis. There is no mathematical basis for that. On the other hand, Kurt Gödel shows that there is no logical system which does not have some unproven axioms. So in a sense, presuppositionalism is answering our culture and causing people to examine their own presuppositions. And my own approach is to combine the two and say, get down to the presuppositions and say, okay, now, let's perform an experiment. Let us presuppose simply that the Holy Scriptures are the infallible Word of God in which God reveals himself, and see, and now let us examine the evidence in light of those presuppositions in addition to your naturalistic presuppositions and see which set of presuppositions fits the evidence. So you go both from the universal to the particulars, and then you go from the particulars to the universal. It's the scientific method. What is work?
Okay. The presupposition that so many people have, I find today, and this is a shocking thing to me because this is not where I was reared. I was reared to think as a scientist thinks, and that is he sets up a proposition and then tests it in the laboratory and refines it and goes back again and tests it and tests it and tests it again, which is a good description of what you've said there. But today I find that there are so many people who, without being aware of it, presuppose that there is no God. That's their presupposition. And I have to pick them up where they are. These people, back in the second century, were presupposing there was a God, but it was a false God. They were presupposing these idols and things were gods. And it was at that point that they said, we have to begin with the facts. The facts there are, here's a miracle. And with that miracle then, you trace it back to find out where that came from. I can show you men in science today. Man is very well known in astrophysics today. And I said to him when he came into the study down there in Bloomington, and he was a graduate student in astrophysics at that point. And he says, I don't want to be an atheist, but I don't want to admit that there's anything I can't know. I don't want to call myself an agnostic. And I said, why don't you read that Bible in the same way that you read your astrophysics books, not expecting to find a mistake behind it, but if God wrote a book, maybe this would be it. And he liked that. He was really an atheist, but he didn't like to admit it because his daddy and mother were godly believers, and he didn't want to contradict them. And as he got into the book, he came to a very real conclusion that there was a very real God who was keeping those things in space out there so that he could study them and had them very well balanced. And I think that that may help to illustrate what it was then. But as I'm listening to people who are witnessing in the science community on campus today, They're coming from a whole different set of presuppositions. Mike, you started to ask us.
You said that
when I give my testimony, when I get to share the gospel, I say,
yeah,
I picked up the New Testament, and I started reading one or two chapters a day, and I was impressed with the words of Jesus Christ, backed up by His miracles, and I was impacted with the truth. If God, if this is truth, I have to deal with it. The miracles of Christ, the words of Christ, brought about the fact that it had to be truth because He did all these things. I'm sorry. That's how I became a Christian.
Yeah, yeah.
Through saying, this is the evidence, therefore Jesus is God. So I guess I'm classical. I don't know. I'm still confused.
Yeah. Jack?
Is saying here that the martyrs were classical because of what they experienced in persecutions, because of the evidence in their life, what Christ had taken them through. And the just martyr was presuppositionist because he thought his way, he outthought the heathen.
No, he's not saying martyr. He's saying martyr was a classical evidentialist. I thought that, wasn't that right? Yeah. Yeah. And he's saying that this was the way apologetics began.
Yeah. I'll need you for me to make another couple more comments. I know we're not last time. But, you know, I also, you know, I very much believe in the Word of God. People have to approach it and start reading it. And they have to at least question their assumption, their unstated assumption, it is mere myth. And so, you know, you come from a different culture than the next guy. I come from a different culture than the next guy. Jesus did not deal with the woman at the well the way he dealt with the scribes and Pharisees, of which Paul told us was one. And, you know, we have to deal with people where they are at. And people today, there are those who do not believe that there is such a thing. And I'm not kidding you. There are people who believe that there is not such a thing as absolute truth. There are people who will say to me, and I've had engineers say this to me, okay? In the realm of science, that's one thing, but in the realm of religion, okay, A is not necessarily not equal to not A. They, you know, what makes engineering work, they arbitrarily, and you have to find these assumptions and question them just to get them to take an honest look at the scriptures.
I think we've accomplished our purpose this evening. I'm not going to flunk anyone in this class for being a presuppositionalist or for being an evidentialist, but I want you to be able to explain to me the difference between those two. And if you have a question about that, let's get together on it. I think you've heard him described, but Michael?
Would it be accurate to say that evidentialism is starting with a blank chalkboard and putting the information, all the evidence down in order to organize the conclusions, and presuppositionalism is starting with an outline and seeing if all the evidence fits to the
outline? That sounds like it would be to presuppose something as compared with evidentialist or starting with a blank board and then going from there. That sounds like, yes, that would begin getting at it. One more shot, Tom.
If we may learn something from God's natural law, a scientist will look at the evidence around him, draw a tentative conclusion, a hypothesis, and then re-examine the evidence in light of that. So
yeah,
he uses both approaches.
And that's the way I was taught to think before I became a Christian. And I'm not saying that as I became a Christian, then that's all wrong. I wasn't saying that. I'm just saying that this was the... I began my career in chemistry. And that was the thing that was drilled into me at that point. I want to call your attention to Philip Schaff's Creeds of Christendom. We've referred in passing here this evening to the Apostles' Creed. And I have put that on the list of books for you to read some of. Philip Schaff's Creeds of Christendom. It's upstairs there. I think that's three volumes. Pretty sure there are of those. That's you really ought to look into that. I believe in God, and you know how the rest of that goes. I hope that you are remembering what Jesus said when he said, "I've yet many things to say unto you, but you cannot bear them now." The writings of the Apostle Paul, the writings of the New Testament from the Gospels on, are some of those things. I cannot tell you all these things now. You can't bear them. You're not ready for them. But later on, they were written. They did come out. This we're going to have to tie off this evening, and we will have a guest here, I believe, next week. You'll be interested in seeing and knowing, and I will pass these tests out now. But Heather, could you slip out a minute? I think probably what I ought to do is pass these out and then run as hard as I can. Well, that could be it. That could be it. How are you able to sing this evening? Are you? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Jack. Happy birthday to you. You have a precious waiter there, Jack. I'd give her a hug if I was you. Well, thank you for letting us share in your birthday tonight. Karen, thank you for all of us. From all of us. Thank you.